I'm speaking with Margaret Trudeau, the former wife of former Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau. In the fall of 2010, Margaret launched her book, Changing My Mind, detailing her experience with bipolar disorder. We'll discuss her bipolar disorder and her life since the book launch. Mrs. Trudeau, welcome to Beautiful Minds.
Well, thank you. Please call me Margaret, Richard.
Oh, thank you. So at one point you were hospitalized.
Oh, yes. I've been through it all.
How did some of the psychiatric patients determine that you were manic?
Well, they tried to, the last time I was put into the hospital, I was severely manic. In fact, I'd gone beyond mania into psychosis, which is the worst part of being in mania, is the possibility of really completely losing your mind into psychosis. And that's the state I was in when I was put into the hospital in 2000 after the death of my husband, Pierre Trudeau. So I pretty much lost my mind, and they gave me another name. I couldn't remember it to protect my privacy, but some of the other patients, and I would forget, and I'd be talking to them, and they thought I was just completely mad because I thought I was Margaret Trudeau. And yes, I know. My psychiatric experiences, because I'm now older, started in the 70s, and all I can say to everybody is that thank goodness it's now. Science has caught up with our disease, with our illness, with our disorders, if you will, with our brain health. And we know now so much more about the brain than we did before. So an awful lot of what I went through in the past, which I detail in my book, while it's relevant from a clinical point of view, because I was suffering bipolar, I was suffering from a debilitating mental illness, and yet I wasn't able to access or get the treatment that you can get now. So it was, the times have changed.
And one of the things you mention in your book, you talk about serotonin levels and
yes.
how laughter contributes to that.
Oh, so much. It really, the thing that you have to understand with bipolar is that it's an imbalance of chemicals in our brain. We have two wonderful chemicals in our brain. Serotonin is one. It's a hormone that comes out of our digestive tract. And we replace it every day by living well, by eating well, by having a good night's sleep, by having healthy sex, by laughing out loud, by going for a walk, by being optimistic, our serotonin levels remain high. But when we become triggered into stress and sadness and overwhelmed by it, our serotonin level goes down, 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 and that leads us into depression. Depression is not sorrow and sadness. Depression is an illness, a debilitating one. I think it's the biggest thief I've ever met, depression, because it took away my life, my ability to participate in life, because without the serotonin, when you're depressed, you have no serotonin or very little in your brain, and it's a jelly-like substance that you need as a conductor, so to transmit the beautiful feelings that come to you when you see something, when your eyes see something beautiful, for example, a beautiful sunset, in a nanosecond, the message is transmitted from one neuron through the serotonin, which is the conductor, to another one, and a click takes place, a synapsis, just in seconds, where you feel, oh, what a lovely sunset, and it makes you happy, and you feel good, or looking into a child's eye, or anything that brings you pleasure. Without the serotonin, there's no click, there's no feeling. So you're just lost in this world without response to any of the good things in life, without any of the delight. Depression is a very gray world. I lived in depression an awful lot. It started with postpartum depression when I was only 22, and that's very typical of the disease. I didn't know it was that. I was told it by a psychiatrist. It was baby blues, and I'd get over it. It wasn't. It was the beginning of the cycle of deep depression and then climbing up into this euphoric mania. And the mania is the problem. That's dopamine. Dopamine, if we could only bottle dopamine, Richard, oh my goodness, would we be wealthy, because it is the drug that makes us feel, the chemical in our brain that makes us feel inspired and full of imagination, full of great passion, great love, great enthusiasm. When you're manic, too much dopamine is flooding your brain so that it is coming in too quickly. So your thoughts are very, very quick, and you can't go beyond one thought to the next. You're just racing. You can't complete a thought. So you never take in What you do in normal, when your brain is functioning normally without this flood of this chemical dopamine, you're not thinking about the consequences of anything you do. You just act so impulsively, so quickly, and you have so much energy, and you think you're the greatest writer, the greatest poet. All you're doing is doodling and scribbling because your thoughts really aren't profound. They're just coming too quickly.
Do you recognize now quickly when you are in those states?
That's part of my recovery was because what I did, what everybody does, when I wasn't getting the proper treatment from the medical system, when my doctors didn't seem to understand what was wrong with me and how they could make a difference other than what I saw as sort of a chemical lobotomy with a lot of drugs that made me not myself, that made me in place. I was in place in the family, but I didn't have any energy or spunk. Getting the right treatment, getting the right help, getting the right balance of the chemicals, and then getting the cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the talk therapy, which made me understand that I've got to know myself, I've got to monitor my moods, I've got to feel myself rising, I've got to feel that dopamine coming in, and I've got to put a stop to it. I found in my journey that while the depression stole me from everyone, stole me from my family, I had no energy, I wasn't doing anything, I wasn't contributing, I wasn't high functioning. The mania made me incredibly high functioning. I seemed to get so much done until it started taking over and getting me out of the perfect stage of hypomania, which is wonderful, and going up into mania. The last stage being psychosis. Nobody wants to go into psychosis. So many people who have mania are addicted to the mania if they are bipolar, because the contrast of the being down in the depths of gray and despair and sadness and then climbing up into this euphoria. You want to be in that euphoria, and yet that is the cycle that I found the most damaging in my life.
When did you last experience euphoria?
I haven't had any mania for years. I haven't had any depression either. I watch it very, very carefully. I do feel joy. I can feel euphoric, and I recognize what I'm feeling is joy, not which comes and goes. I mean, you feel great joy, for example, when I'm with my grandchildren or holding a newborn, great joy. But that comes and goes. What mania is, you're always on this high state of high excitement. And the things that can happen to you, well, first of all, you can spend every bit of money you have. You can start borrowing every bit of money anybody will give you because you think you're so powerful. You keep spending and spending. And I've heard it again and again how bank accounts have been emptied. Houses have had to be mortgaged because the manic person who was in charge of money really shouldn't have been, because you can't think ahead. You don't think about saving. You don't think about being careful. You don't think about others. Your brain's moving too fast. It's a disorder, and it has to be corrected. I've learned to, and my depression, that's the one that I've had to battle the most. I haven't had that many manic episodes. I've certainly lived more in depression. And depression is a point of view. Once you're out of the depression, once the serotonin is back in your body, you have to maintain it. Now, how do you maintain the serotonin that you've got artificially from an antidepressant if you want to go off the antidepressant? Well, you run. You walk, you climb, you jump, you dance, you get yourself physically busy.
Garden.
You garden. You laugh. You make sure you see comedy shows instead of news shows before you go to sleep. That was one of my doctor's recommendations.
Or the combo, right?
Exactly. Yeah,
I understand you like the Daily Show,
yeah,
and the Colbert Report.
Yeah, I do.
Report.
I know. Funny news. Yeah, no, you have to learn to laugh, and you have to learn to stop yourself from going down the path that you've got a very, once you've had episodes of depression, many episodes of depression, your brain has a very easy channel then to that way of thinking, that way of being, which is a defeated and a pessimistic way of being. And it drags you down into it where you stop accepting, you start feeling the depression coming in, the sadness overwhelming you, you stop feeling energetic, you don't want to do things, you start canceling appointments, you stop doing your runs or your walks, and you start isolating. And that's the beginning of depression, that's very easy for the brain to put you into that place. You have to fight it. The brain's very plastic. You can say, no, 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 not going there today. Have no time for this depression. I'm not going to be hauled into it. Because if you get your serotonin up by being positive immediately, an immediate response, also from the food you eat, omega fish oil or flaxseed oil, omega-3s are the most important, and vitamin B12 is our supplements for our mental health, the most important. Those are the only two that my doctor ever told me to always stick with, omega-3 and B12, because it's very good for your mental health.
Now, through your book and through your speaking engagements, you've heard from people tell their candid stories of dealing with mental illness. What story really stands out in your mind?
I have two, and they're the opposite. One was, I was speaking up in Port Elgin, which is in Northern Ontario. It was Canadian auto workers, and I didn't know what I was doing there, but they were having a conference on mental health safety, so I was the keynote speaker. I was speaking to about 100 miners and truckers, and not my usual mental health audience, healthcare workers or whatever, but it was a wonderful audience. And afterwards, a woman stood up and she said to me, Margaret, she said, my sister, she was from Saskatchewan, my sister left me with her kids and ran off to Calgary. I've just been so angry with her. I've just hated her. You've just changed my hate and my anger into compassion. I'm going to go and find her and try and get her some help. And that's exactly what I wanted to do and what I was able to do. But then I have, nothing is perfect in life. And so then I had one gentleman in the prairies come up to me. He was clutching his book. He didn't want me to sign it, but he was clutching. He said, Mrs. Trudeau, I read your book. He said, it changed my life. I left my wife. She was nuttier than you ever were. And I went,
oh, no.
But it has to go two ways. Life isn't an easy street. And he took from it, I guess, that he didn't have to put up with anymore. But in fact, what I'm asking in my book and what I'm asking from everyone is to start the conversation, to talk about how you really feel, talk about your feelings of despair and loneliness before they get too deep. Let the people who are closest to you take your hand and help you get help, because you have to live it the best you can be in order to be a happy person, in order to have spark and life and interest. You have to deal with your mental issues. And I have had to deal with mine all my life. And I must say, in the last years, I find an awful lot of people are listening. I found that people want to hear more about emotional and mental difficulties, want to know more about brain health, want to understand how they can help those in their families. And people want to know how they can help themselves. The only thing that, from my experience, I know is it has to come from you. You have to want the help. So many people go through the act, and they go to the psychologist or the psychiatrist, and they go into treatment, and they take the drugs, but they haven't really committed to changing how they think, to thinking in a different, entirely different way. I had to give up anger and bitterness and jealousy and all those emotions that were just too raw and strong in me and weren't giving me peace. And I found that since I've been able to become a much more loving person, compassionate, accepting, empathetic person, and not a judging person, I'm a happy person. So.
And this was a best-selling memoir. What's the next step?
Well, as my doctor keeps telling me, Margaret, you can talk the talk, but can you walk the walk? And that's a different thing. That's one thing to be able to write a book about defining the whole problem, opening up the door for people to understand what bipolar is, what depression is, what. And I have doctors writing in my book as well with authority. I don't pretend to be a medical expert. But I have found in my path in the last 10 years an awful lot of happiness, not just, and I'm looking for it, and I'm finding it in other women's lives. I'm finding it coming all around me, that when you're looking for it, it's there. So the next book, I hope, is going to be, again, stories, but this time about how to make really good choices to be happy. I think we can choose to be happy in our lives. We can choose to wake up and grumble all day and be bitter and angry and judge others and find satisfaction satisfaction in others, and others doing bad instead of good, or we can wake up with optimism and love and saying, just what is this beautiful day going to bring me? And you know, the only way a day is going to bring you much is if you are participate in it, if you're active in it, if you're kind in it, if you smile in it, if you do good things for other people, you'll find people do good things for you. I have a strong belief in the now, which sometimes is a problem because I sometimes forget about tomorrow and the things that I've committed to, not committed to, but promises I've made or whatever, because I like to take everything out of the day that is, because it's really all we've got.
So will this be your own anecdotes of happiness?
I will be telling all the stories that I, some will be, a lot of them will be other people's stories too that I've gathered, you know, other women's stories in my family and my friends, amongst people I know, amongst people I've seen out on the road, which will always be triggered by an observation at the top, you know, whatever. Anyway, I think who knows, I'm just starting it. So we'll see what the end product is.
And when can we expect to see that book?
I think in 2013, sometime maybe.
Let's go back to when you were a young child. You talk about this fear of mortality and infinity. What exactly was going through your mind?
I think as all children, and I've watched this in my grandchildren, some of us have a large emotional range, some of us have a small one. Some of us dwell on dark things, and some never even think of them. And I've seen this amongst my children, my grandchildren. I was a kind of child who just saw it all. I'm Quicksilver Girl, my dad used to call me, because he said I was so mercurial, which indeed I am a Virgo, so maybe that's right, but just quick to be happy, quick to be sad. I would see things that would just break my heart and I would cry. We were driving down for today, another example, we were driving, my daughter and I are driving down from Whistler, and there's a terrible accident that we are having to pass. And Allie's saying to me, Mommy, don't look left or right. You're driving. You can't be sad right now. You can't cry. Right, right. But I hurt for other people. Some people do. I hurt. I suffer. And I had to learn to not take quite so much, take it all quite so seriously. Some elderly person, I just read a wonderful thing called The Legacy Project that comes out of an octogenarian in the States who studied all these seniors to find out what makes them happy. And universally, their one regret, our wise old ones, is that they spend so much time worrying about things that never happened. Right. So if you can not so worry so much and think doom, dark thoughts, and try and think more positively, I think your life would be a better one. Mine is.
Now, you just returned from Whistler, and that's where you and Pierre went after you were married.
Yes.
So when you go back there, do thoughts of the past
And you know, I have a trick that I do, because I'm worried about losing my wonderful memories, because I have a lot. I'm getting a lot down in books and poetry that I'm writing. But however, I like to refresh each day. I sort of look at my mind like my little computer. So I go in and I think about the day, and I take the memories that were the best ones, and I try and redo them. I think again, the smell, the sight, where I was, who I saw, what are the feelings, and so that they're fresh. And then I pull up from time to time an old memory and freshen it up and bring it to the forefront of my mind. Our memories are our gifts, particularly if we've lived wonderful lives.
What do you mean freshen it up?
Well, just really work hard to bring up all the details of it, to think about it again, to get it clear again, to get it right. I mean, your memories are all stored there. If we have 80,000 thoughts a day, think of the memories we have in our brains and all that we live.
But do you also try to take some of the negative experiences and look at them in a different light?
Do you know what? That's already done for us, mostly. The brain has a protective memory. Most of the horrors, you can't recall the smells and the details of them. You don't. It's the fine memories I pull up. No, if my mind is taken down into a path of, because I've lost a son, so I live with sadness and sorrow every day, and I let myself feel the sadness, but I don't let it pull me down into that dark, dark place of loneliness and despair and lack of hope. And I have lived there, and that's not a place to live.
When was the last time you really broke down crying over his death?
Oh, well, all the time. And it's something, at first it's something you feel you're so public about, and then it becomes, I was able to get him with the help, actually tremendous Aboriginal healing really was what finally did it for me. It was from one of the Aboriginal wise sisters. She was able to release him from me so that he was soaring instead of me carrying him, the burden of him in me, the loss of him in me, I let him go. And that's the same thing as belief, the Christian belief in resurrection and faith. And so I was able to feel him soar away. And so the hurt wasn't the same kind of hurt. It's a missing. And the years go on. I mean, it's been 12 years now, so I don't expect him to walk through the door. In the first years, you do. You know, your memories are so huge. We keep him alive. He's a wonderful spirit, our boy.
Right. I see you wiping a little bit your
yeah,
eyes.
I cry.
So is it?
I cry every day. But it's just something you do. Apparently, our tears are healing. They have a little hormone in them that makes us feel better after we've had a good cry. So I'm all for crying. It was terrible, the grief of losing a child. I don't know a grief that's worse. I haven't ever had one worse. I can't imagine there isn't anyone worse, I don't suppose. And you just have to face it. And my doctor would say, Margaret, you have to own your grief. Oh, I would have given it away to the first person who offered to take it from me. But nobody can take it from you. You go through it. And then you find joy on the other side once you've accepted death. Once you know that death is part of life. My son's time was his time. He'd had a great life. I'll join him someday.
And one element in death, of course, is denial. And you share a joke about denial when you give your talks.
I do. So I try and pepper as much as I can my speeches that I give, which are more like conversations, with jokes, because it just relieves the air so much, particularly if you've just been talking about death. So this joke is these two. It's such a sweet one. To an elderly couple, he is convinced that she's rapidly losing her hearing. She's in complete denial. She won't even go to the audiologist. No way. There's nothing wrong with her hearing. So he goes. He doesn't know what to do. So he goes to the hearing doctor, and he said, well, without her hear, I can't help her. But wait a minute. We could find out the range of her hearing loss. So why don't you start 50 feet away from her and in 10-foot increments, get closer, and we can figure out how much she hears. So he starts in the living room. Honey, what's for dinner? No answer. The dining room. Honey, what's for dinner? No answer. Closer, closer, closer. Finally, right up to her. Honey, what's for dinner? For the fifth time, chicken.
I so laughed. I laughed out loud when I read it in your book. And just hearing you tell it is actually even better than
well, I like
reading
to tell jokes, and I've got a lot in my repertoire, but not many that I do in public.
And are there still elements of your own life that you feel you're in partial denial?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think everybody... I didn't get to become perfect. All I got was I got on a level playing field by spending 3 years seriously correcting the way I thought, the way I was, changing my mind, as the book is titled. But all it did was put me on even playing field with people who think normally and properly and have excellent brain health. My brain health is good now. I still get hurt and I cry. I get wounded. I still feel frustrated. I still feel lonely. I feel all those things. But now I know how, when I feel those things, how to react to them. If I feel lonely, I say, my goodness, Margaret, you just have to pick up the phone. There's so many good friends you have out there who could change your point of view in 1 second. Or just do get cooking, get gardening, get outside, go see the grandchildren, do something to change your mood. So I've learned how to deal with life. I think every day you don't know what life's going to throw at you.
Does a day ever pass when you don't think about having bipolar disorder?
Oh, yeah. I still am in denial that I'm even bipolar, but that's part of me. I'm not really, I'm just joking. No, I clearly had serious mental illness, but I have been so well for so long because I choose balance. I get every night a really good night's sleep. Every day I exercise. Every day I don't eat anything that's junk. I don't eat anything that's processed. I don't eat anything that has chemicals in it. I just eat clean, simple, delicious food. I love to cook, too.
Well, it's said that all truths are said in jest, and you say you're joking that there's a denial, but is there a grain of truth?
Oh, no, I don't. I really don't believe so. Actually, I know so, because while I haven't had any extremes in the last years, one of my things that I think is very true is that our mental health is very tied to our hormones. And for women, and my episodes of really scary mania and so low depression was when my hormones were fluctuating as a woman after childbirth, when I weaned a baby, PMS, menopause. Those things really were rough on me. I'm on the other side now, so I'm looking back saying, oh, I've got peace. But it hormones may, and all the scientists and all the doctors and researchers are looking into it now, of the incredible complexity of our hormones and how they trigger us into, they don't cause us our mental illness, they trigger us into episodes by their fluctuations, and the same for men as well with theirs. So there's all new ways of looking at. I find every day that I'm learning new things about new treatments for getting people out of depression. I find the internet extraordinary. I'd give all of your listeners one piece of advice. Great West Life has the best virtual web page for mental health that I know anywhere. Great West Life is a huge insurance company. It's to their bottom line interest to have us all healthy, high functioning, and working hard. When you leave your job on group disability because of depression, if you don't get treatment, it's very unlikely that you'll ever be able to be back working the way you did before. So without treatment, so they're really into mental health, and I've accessed papers from the Mayo Institute down in the States, from all over the world, on whatever I want to learn about from this. GreatWestLife.com. Go in and find their mental health site. It's great information.
If you look at all of the ways having bipolar disorder has affected your life, if you could go back, would you choose not to have bipolar disorder?
No, because I've had such a joyful life. I've had such an exciting life. I've had so many rich, beautiful things happen to me in my life because I do have energy, and I do reach out and I stretch my eyes, and I've always asked the questions, and I've always had a sense of adventure. I go too far. Pierre used to say to me, I would exaggerate. I mean, I exaggerate, but that's what my emotions were, so high, so enthusiastic, so sad. I think that I've had a zest for life, and I think it's been a gift. In some ways, my bipolar, it's also been a terrible thing untreated, because I've damaged so much and so many relationships and hurt so many opportunities I could have had because of the illness. And that's what I'd like to prevent other people from doing, is accept it early, accept it right away when you don't feel yourself. Get some help. Talk to someone. Even the act of talking might be the thing that will keep you from falling deeper and deeper into a depression.
Your relationship with Pierre began after you picked up and moved to Ottawa, and at age 21, knocked on his door. Do you think the beginning of that relationship, the sudden move and the boldness of knocking on his door, was prompted or enabled at all by bipolar disorder?
Oh yes. But it wasn't quite as impulsive. We were already destined to be together. There was no question that I had to make that move. But it surprised him that I did it so quickly. But that was me. I was very impulsive, and that's part of the illness. One of the bandwagons that I'm on right now, Richard, is to try and get hospitals for psychiatric facilities facilities for women who are incarcerated in our country. There's one such facility in Ontario, a federal facility called the St. Lawrence Seaway facility, and prisoners are identified 6 to 8 months before they're to be released and put into this rather wonderful facility to be given very, very good psychiatric care, which gives them a toolbox to go out into the world with, to be able to change, to be able to deal with. And we have no such thing for women. We only, and I think that Mr. Harper, our Prime Minister now, it's wrong thinking to think that we need, all evidence shows we don't need more prisons, we don't need more cells, we need more beds to treat mentally ill people, because a lot of the people who are committing crimes are doing it out of impulsivity and compulsivity and aren't real hardened criminals. They will go to jail. Antidepressants, apparently, according to John Bradford, who's the head of forensic psychiatry at the St. Lawrence Seaway, the crime rate is so down because of the millions and millions of people in the Western world who are taking antidepressants, which do take away your compulsivity for small things. I mean, you wouldn't think of doing things that, you know, sort of can change your life, throwing a rock through a window or whatever you're doing that is wrong. You know it's wrong, but you do it anyway. With the antidepressant, you wouldn't do it.
Many people don't seek treatment because there is such a big stigma around mental illness. And I know you experienced that even when you had your press conference.
Always. I think I see it every day. I have an extra ear that listens to how people talk and what people say. And you know what? I study Buddhism an awful lot, and I know that love and fear can't exist together. True love does not have fear in it. True love is a giving thing. It's everything. But fear is what keeps people from being truly loving. And when they're full of fear, then they become hateful, and then they become discriminatory, and they push people away rather than holding them in. And only love will change the world. We know that. But I think most of the stigma, most of the discrimination, most of the bad jokes and everything, it's just fear, because they don't understand. If someone had a broken arm, then there's nothing but sympathy. But when someone's got their brain not working quite correctly, then there's no sympathy, because it's confusing. It's not clear. There isn't something they can label quickly. And it's not that way anymore. I like to think, instead of mental health, I like to correct myself in my mind and say, no, I'm talking about brain health. I'm talking about having the best brain and taking care of your brain, protecting it from injury. My bipolar may have started from two concussions I had as a child. That can come into it, that head injury can be the thing that jiggles your brain and upsets the chemical balance. So, you know, who knows where it comes from, but all the reality is that I have to deal with it. And I do. And because I deal with it, and I was so afraid to deal with it, and I had all the misconceptions of everybody, I'd seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But now I have a completely different appreciation and tremendous gratitude to the healthcare workers that work so hard to try and give people peace, to try and give people peace of mind, and that's all we're all searching for.
Most people would experience stigma just on a one-on-one basis, but for you, it was very public and in the press.
I don't care about the public. I don't read the press. I mean, that didn't matter anything to me, because it actually quite, if you think about it for a second, we are just ourselves. I'm only me. I have sisters. I have a mom, a dad. I have my daily life. I mean, I'm a real person to me. So whatever people are judging out there from the press, from somebody, what other people have said, and them passing judgment, how dare they? They don't know me. When did I meet them? Did they actually sit and talk to me? No. So I dismissed very long ago that kind of gossip as being relevant to me. People can talk all they want. It's not going to bother me, because I know who I am. People who love me know who I am. And I've always stuck to, and that's how Pierre taught me to do it, to just ignore it.
But at the time, and I believe you refer to this in your book, it was hurtful,
oh,
right?
Oh, very, because my emotions were all over the place, and I would get very hurt. And I would feel, I would take it personally, not realizing the political, very political nature of it. For example, I was married to a very powerful prime minister with a lot of opposition, so no wonder I got stuck with a few of the thorns that were being cast. But anyway, never mind, that's all part of life. You, each one of us has a job just to live the best life we can, and each day to wake up and be open to being the best you can be. And if you're not treated, if you're not taking it seriously, if you haven't taken on what you know you have, mental issues that you cannot resolve, either depression or anger or gambling or compulsivity or any of the things that our brain can trick us into, if you don't get help, then that's the shame. The shame is not having a mental illness. The shame is having one, or a disorder, or not feeling yourself and not getting help, because there is help out there. There really is, you know.
So tell me a little bit about how photography and gardening and other...
I think that everything that people do that gives them a sense... For me, I'm very earthbound. And when you're raising your children, each child is different. You find out, what is it that turns this little guy on? Is he like boats, or does he like cars? Does he like to dig? Does he like to play? Whatever. I feel that I'm a person who gets tremendous satisfaction out of the nurturing one thing. I love to look after babies and children. I love to garden and cook. Cooking to me, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. The whole process of it is so lovely to me, and it ends up with fun around the table with everyone, you know, feeling the basic need met of food. Our family spends a lot of time thinking about food, talking about food, emailing about food, and making food. We celebrate a lot with food too.
And then last, what effect does working as a role model for others play in your recovery?
Well, I don't think it's so much as a role model, because in many ways, in some of the stories that you were alluding to in my book, are dire warnings. Not, I don't go down that path. This happened to me because I didn't know better. I didn't know about what was really going on in my brain, that I had no ability to stop it, unless I didn't. But God help. But I think we're plastic. We can change. We can live. We can be anything we want if we open ourselves up, you know, instead of being closed down. So open up your heart and start the conversation.
Well, I look forward to your book on happiness.
Well, we'll see. I would never write a book on happiness, but I think it's going to be a very positive book, because that's the way I've learned to get the most out of the day.
Well, Margaret, thanks for coming on Beautiful Minds.
Oh, I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you, Richard.